set course for China. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. World leaders en route to China for the G20 summit. In previous discussions, President Obama has pushed for fixes to climate change. The next U.S. president might not have the same agenda, but China might not care.
China has the world's largest wind and solar industries. I don't think they're going to be turning around just because of the results of the election.
Also, after a week of conflicting rumors, one of the world's most brutal dictators is confirmed dead. We'll hear about Uzbekistan's Islam Karimov and his long reign of terror. Plus, we go grocery shopping in Venezuela.
We're now inside the shopping center where they've closed the store. A lot of people are angry about it. Some of these people have been outside since 4 a.m.
Those stories today here on The World. Thank you for being here. Top of the agenda today, China and this weekend's G20 summit. Leaders from across the globe, including Barack Obama, will gather in the southern city of Hangzhou. Yeah, the G20 can often seem snoozers, but for China, this is the largest gathering of world leaders in its history. So the spotlight on the host country is hot this time around. Environmentalists will be paying extra close attention. Presidents Obama and Xi Jinping may take the final step toward accepting last year's climate deal in Paris. We'll have more on that in a few minutes. Let's first check in with Mary Kay Magstad. She's a longtime friend of The World who is based in China for us.
What China hopes it gains from any major international event in China is prestige. And the Chinese government is deeply invested in making sure everything goes smoothly. And so they really stage manage the event to the extent that they've even made people leave their homes in apartment buildings near the event in case anyone would try to, you know, have some kind of protest or anything that would embarrass the Chinese government. China also would like to be seen by other members of the G20 as being a rising leader in the global economy. Now, if China were making this play 5-6 years ago, I think a lot of people would have actually bought onto that. But with the Chinese economy slowing and with the Xi Jinping administration being a little more protectionist, actually, than China has been in the past, making it more difficult for foreign investors coming in, you can see in the numbers that foreign investment has barely been growing. It was like 3% last year. And I think there's a little more wariness about China as any kind of a major global player and global leader related to the economy. China still matters a lot. But in terms of China setting the rules and saying how the game is going to be played, I have the feeling that the people who are gathering in Hangzhou will listen, but you know they will also keep their own counsel.
The U.S. pivot to Asia, I mean, this is going to be kind of the headline of Obama's legacy in the Far East. But how much of a pivot was it really? And what can Obama count as his legacy on China?
Right. Well, so you have to go back and think about how it felt to Asians in general and Southeast Asians in particular during the administration of George W. Bush. There was a lot of focus on terrorism and on the Middle East, and Asia felt neglected. And China took advantage of that and made a pitch to its neighbors of, you know, look, we're having this peaceful rise. We're going to share our prosperity with the region, you know, play ball with us. And a lot of people thought that sounds pretty good. When President Obama came into office, he made a point of getting to Asia in general and Southeast Asia in particular often. He's made 10 trips to Asia during his tenure. And I think part of his legacy will be that the United States now has stronger alliances with Southeast Asian countries, and that Southeast Asian countries have recognized that it's in their interests to have a balance in their relationships between the U.S. and China.
Mary Kay, it is hard to talk about China and not mention human rights. This is Obama's last moment, really, to speak openly with the Chinese about human rights. What can he say? What should be his parting shot?
Well, I know Human Rights Watch has called on him, the 2009 Nobel Peace Prize winner, to speak up and call for the release of the 2010 Nobel Peace Prize winner, Liu Xiaobo, who's in prison for having called for greater democracy in China. There are many ways in which President Obama can point out concerns about human rights in China. There's been an incredible crackdown over the last 3 years on journalists, on lawyers who have been, you know, trying to actually work according to China's constitution to protect people's rights in courts. Basically, the government under Xi Jinping has been saying, you know, whatever we say is the right way to do things is the only way to do things. And if you criticize us, you know, you risk facing serious trouble, whether it's losing your job or losing your social media accounts or being thrown in prison. It's a very tense environment for people who challenge the government.
All right, Mary Kay, we're going to leave things there. Thanks as always.
Thank you, Marco.
Mary Kay is a host of our podcast, Whose Century Is It? You can find out more at pri.org/whosecentury and subscribe via iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. President Obama made a couple of stops on his way to the G20. He touched down in Hawaii and the Midway Islands as part of an effort to highlight his fight against climate change. It's clear the president wants to cement his legacy as an environmental leader, and that effort is likely to continue when Obama sits down with Chinese President Xi Jinping at the G20. Here's the world's Carolyn Beeler.
Presidents Obama and Xi are set to talk climate change at the summit. And before it even starts on Sunday, they may announce that they've taken the final step needed to join the International Climate Change Agreement crafted in Paris last December. Longtime China watcher Orville Schell says these two superpowers issuing their final acceptance is key in ensuring the agreement actually goes into effect.
It is unthinkable that we would solve this problem unless the U.S. and China are part of the solution.
That's because together, the two countries emit about 40% of the world's carbon dioxide.
So that's why it's so important.
More countries would still need to accept for the Paris Agreement to go into effect, but this move by the U.S. and China would still be a big deal. To get a sense of why, historically, Schell, who's with the Asia Society, says you have to look back just a bit.
Originally, you know, 5-6 years ago, China tended to view climate change as sort of a plot foisted on them by the West to slow down their development.
Development the country felt it had a right to.
The West, after all, had its industrial revolution. Why shouldn't China?
Schell credits an amped-up U.S. focus on China after failed 2009 climate talks in Copenhagen with helping change the country's thinking.
Because of the tremendous efforts that the United States made through universities, through national labs, through environmental NGOs, China did slowly come around and began to recognize this was a threat to China, too.
China and the U.S. then became sort of tandem leaders in the climate movement. An agreement to cut emissions between those two superpowers in 2014 paved the way for the huge international deal in Paris. But it's not clear if this tag-team approach will continue. Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton has said she'd largely continue Obama's climate policies. But Republican nominee Donald Trump says he doesn't believe in climate change. He's even tweeted that it's a hoax made up by the Chinese to hurt America's economy.
I think it's a big scam for a lot of people to make a lot of money.
This is Trump on Fox News last December.
China is eating our lunch because they don't partake in all of the rules and regulations that we do. And then they compete because they're spending a lot less money to build their products and to make their products.
Trump said in an energy speech in May that he'd cancel the Paris Agreement. Now, he couldn't actually do that, but he could pull the U.S. out. Which begs the question, if the U.S. reneges on its promises, would China do the same? From Beijing, the Natural Resources Defense Council's Alvin Lin says probably not.
Policymakers in China are watching what's happening in the U.S., but really China is committed to fulfilling its goals under the Paris Agreement, regardless of what happens in the U.S. or any other country. This is really for their own benefit.
Lin says choking smog in China's major cities and money to be made in green energy are motivation enough to cut pollution.
China has the world's largest wind and solar industries. They are really pushing on electric vehicles. These are all sectors they see as future growth areas. I don't think they're going to be turning around just because of the results of the election.
But U.S. leadership will have an impact on China's carbon emissions in other ways. China and the U.S. work together on electric vehicles, on energy-efficient buildings, and on carbon capture techniques. Ranping Song from the World Resources Institute says if U.S. support for that research drops off,
that may actually slow down a few years down the road.
And scientists say countries can't afford to slow down their carbon reductions. In fact, they have to speed them up if they want to prevent the most catastrophic impacts of climate change. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Voters in Hong Kong go to the polls on Sunday to choose a new legislative council. It sounds routine, but nothing is really routine in this former British colony. For one thing, it's the only part of China that has real elections. And now there's a growing campaign for independence. The World's Patrick Nguyen is following events from Bangkok. So what is at stake here, Patrick?
Well, there's 7 million people voting to fill out 70 seats in this legislature, a legislature that's actually created back in the colonial era when the British ran Hong Kong. These days, it's mostly stacked with pro-Beijing, pro-business types, and Beijing has a way of making sure that this legislative council doesn't contain any radicals, anyone who really wants to rock the boat.
We know China places such huge value on Hong Kong. What chance does this independence movement have?
I would say nil. Yeah. There was a poll that's
pretty straight up and down.
There was a poll that suggests 1 in 6 people in Hong Kong favor independence, which sounds like enough. Then you consider the fact that 50% of the people in the poll said no way, and then only 4% in the poll said they even thought it was possible. So I think you have people out there that embrace the fantasy of independence and they like the notion, but realistically they know it's just not going to happen.
And yet the young activists who are behind this, they are super committed. I mean, they cut their teeth in those heady pro-democracy protests in the streets of Hong Kong 2 years ago that pretty much stopped the city in its tracks. Tell us about some of these young activists.
You know, advocating for independence, you know, Hong Kong as a new country, that is still pretty radical and pretty fringe. What these activists are trying to do is loosen Beijing's grip on the election process.
Now, there's also kind of mainstream opposition people who've been standing up to China for years, people like lawmaker Emily Lau. They're pretty pragmatic when it comes to this sort of stuff. Are they behind the independence movement?
You will not hear them say Hong Kong should be an independent country. You really won't. That's still a little far out.
They believe it?
They might. Some of them. They know better than to say it because once you say that, you're disqualified. You're out. You can't be a politician anymore. So they would be throwing everything that the power that they have gained down the toilet.
So, Patrick, one story you've done this week focuses on another group in Hong Kong. These are people who are campaigning not just for independence. They're going beyond that. They're calling for a restoration of British control. Like, they want to go back to pre-1997 and the days of the British Empire. Are they for real?
I know it's laughable, but they're completely serious. Yes, they want Hong Kong to go back to being a British colony. And the degree to which they fetishize the colonial era is interesting. They're very fond of the queen. They like to call her the boss. They actually stand out on the street corners in Hong Kong drinking tea and eating biscuits and trying to educate Hong Kongers about the Magna Carta. And they like to wave around the Union Jack. And they're interesting.
So, I mean, with these elections coming up, what's the risk of more protests in the future, the near future?
The young activists that I've talked to are very much focused on gaining a foothold in these elections. So if the elections don't go their way or they feel that there's manipulation, then you might see more protests. Now, you are seeing gatherings in Hong Kong now. There was actually a very shocking gathering that was pro-independence that attracted about 2,000 people not too long ago. And you would even have people in that crowd that were waving not the British flag, but the Hong Kong colonial flag, which looks like the Union Jack with a special seal for Hong Kong. You know, this is pretty provocative stuff in Beijing's eyes. However, the crowds aren't so big and they're not so disruptive that Beijing feels like they need to really move in there and squash them.
The World's Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok. Thanks so much, Patrick.
Thanks, Marco.
Coming up, a reporter gets a rare experience, a front row seat for an annular eclipse here on The World. There is no other way to put it. Venezuela is a mess these days. Crippling inflation, rising crime, life-threatening shortages of food and medicine, and massive political demonstrations, some calling for the president to go, others to stay. We've been speaking with different people in Caracas who've told us about some of this. My BBC colleague Vladimir Hernandez, who is originally from Venezuela, recently returned home and gave us his perspective.
It's midday here in Palmarejo, a small town in western Venezuela. A middle-aged woman is hunched over an old gas stove in her dimly lit home, consisting of corrugated iron walls and a tin roof. Sulay Florido is not particularly tall, but has a commanding presence. She's cooking breakfast, lunch, and dinner, all rolled into one.
My daughters go out to beg to feed their kids. One of them is pregnant and doesn't have anything to eat, and she has to go out to beg. I go to my neighbors. I wash her dishes. I sweep her floor in return for breakfast for me and the baby.
What's going on here is happening all over Venezuela. A study by three of the country's main universities suggests that 90% of Venezuelans are eating less than they did last year, and that extreme poverty has jumped by 53% since 2014. I wanted to keep my own family out of this, to avoid it becoming personal, but there are some things you can't ignore.
It's one thing to talk to people who you've never met before, who are facing hunger, who are not being able to feed themselves three times a day. It's completely different when you meet members of your own family, like my father, because he has lost so much weight. He used to be a robust man, and now you can see his cheekbones. He admits it's because he's not feeding himself properly. And seeing that in the flesh with your own father just really brings home what's happening here.
The vast drop in the price of oil has shattered Venezuela's economy, although the opposition says it's all down to the government's mismanagement. In towns and cities all over Venezuela, many people have to stand in line just to get hold of pasta, rice or flour. These things are available on the black market, but at prices many people can't afford.
We're at the end of what's like a 600-person queue right now, selling, we found out, nappies and washing powder. But also they're selling flour, which is crucial. As soon as we went by, some woman started saying, "We're hungry here. You should come and talk to us."
We're now inside the shopping centre where they've closed the store. A lot of people are angry about it. Some of these people have been outside since 4 a.m.
Those with the means are moving elsewhere. Valesca Barrueta, a young university student, is giving up on Venezuela, like many of her contemporaries.
I'm planning on leaving Venezuela. I want to start a life. I want to be able to save money so I can buy a house, so I can have normal things, food. And I'm not going to be able to do that, not here.
The saddest thing that I've seen in this country throughout this time is that people have lost the power of deciding when and what to eat. And it's such a simple idea, but it's so significant in anyone's life. When you meet people at food queues or at roadblocks where they're protesting to get food, the look in their eyes is extremely sad. There are people trying to fix this, but the problem is just too big.
The BBC's Vladimir Hernandez there, reporting from Venezuela. I've been lucky enough to witness two total solar eclipses in my lifetime. Never seen an annular eclipse, though. That's where the sun, moon, and earth are in perfect alignment. But with an annual eclipse, the moon is a bit too far from the earth to completely eclipse the sun. What you do get, though, is a bright ring of fire as the moon almost covers the disk of the sun. Journalist Daniel Gross was lucky enough to see an annular eclipse yesterday. Tell us what you saw and where you were.
Yeah, I was in a village in Tanzania called Lupiro. And I was able to see the eclipse cover about 94% of the sun. So there was kind of this halo, this ring of bright light, sort of looked like something out of a religious painting from, you know, the Renaissance. And inside the halo, the kind of brightly lit clouds that were really bright white, there was this sliver, this banana-shaped or crescent-shaped sliver of the sun that was visible. And right in the center of the sun, there was this dark ring of the moon right in the center. And every time the clouds would pass over the sun, even with the naked eye, you could tell most of the sun was covered up. And looking around in the middle of the eclipse during the peak, it felt like twilight. It was noon. It was 12:03 when it peaked. And it still felt like, you know, 6 p.m. It felt like the sun was going down.
Now, I know you're in Tanzania reporting for us. Did you schedule this assignment to coincide with this eclipse, or did it kind of come as a surprise once you got on the ground?
So I'm here to follow around a group of scientists, Danish and Swedish scientists, that are collaborating with a bunch of Tanzanian entomologists. These entomologists, these bug scientists, are trying to figure out if a solar eclipse affects the amount of mosquitoes that come out. So in a way, I did plan it to coincide with the eclipse because the scientists wanted to study that.
Right.
And their big question is, during an eclipse, do insects come out of the fields, come out of the rice paddies that surround this village? And they did seem to notice a little bit of a spike in the amount of insects that came out. It seemed like some insects are reacting to the amount of light.
Well, we're going to hear those reports when you come back. It's pretty fascinating, though, studying mosquitoes during a solar eclipse. Eclipses have fascinated but also frightened people for centuries. Were you with other observers when you saw this eclipse, and what kind of reactions did you see?
I was with other observers, so I was with this group of scientists, and then there were also just some villagers that came out. I think that the Europeans and the Tanzanians were pretty equally moved by this event. One of the Danish engineers that I spoke with told me that, you know, it felt very strange that in the middle of the day it was getting dark.
Half an hour before sunset, you understand clearly why people in older times thought that there was something completely wrong, gods punished them or whatever. I mean, it's a really strange phenomenon.
And I also spoke to a Tanzanian bug scientist. This is someone who really devotes his life to the study of malaria. He told me that he wanted to tell his sons about it.
I haven't seen this for such a long time, maybe since I was born.
And what's it like to see it?
I feel amazing, indeed. A good experience even to tell my sons. When they come home, like, Dad, what's this kind of solar eclipse? Then I'll be in a good way saying I've witnessed this.
We, of course, know precisely when eclipses happen, many years into the future. Were there kids who were preparing for this, and did they have, you know, protective glasses or pinhole cameras to check it out?
It would have been nice. This is really a poor, poor village. The kids don't really have shoes. Some of them are wearing tattered clothing. They speak zero English. We did play a lot with them, and they would yell Mzungu, which is the word for a light-skinned person. We had these pieces of tinted glass that welders use, so they can look at the really bright flame. And we were using those to look at the sun. And so we did show them how to see it, trying to be very careful to shield their eyes from looking directly at the sun. And they got pretty excited about that.
Reporter Daniel Gross in Tanzania, who was following around some mosquito scientists and ran into an eclipse when the sky got dark. Daniel, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead on The World, looking back, 350 years ago today, the Great Fire of London started. It was a devastating blaze.
The noise and cracking and thunder of the impetuous flames, the shrieking of the women and children, the fall of towers, houses, and churches.
That story ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Earlier this week, Uzbekistan's president, Islam Karimov, was hospitalized after a brain hemorrhage. Then came days of confirmations and retractions of his death. But now it's official. Uzbek state television has announced today that Karimov has died. Natalia Antalava is a reporter. She joins us from Tbilisi in Georgia. It was a weird week of announcements and retractions of Karimov's death. So now it's official. What does this mean politically for the country in the days ahead?
At the moment, I think everyone who's been watching this is feeling a little bit of relief that finally Uzbekistan has managed to get itself out of what has been a denial. We have very strong sources that said back on Monday that he had died. It took the Uzbek government 5 days. For 5 days, they were adamant saying that no, he is still alive. The Uzbek state television was playing videos of Islam Karimov meeting various businessmen. And yesterday, some diplomats were saying that they had already received invitations to the funeral. We had pictures of the preparations for the funeral, and still the Uzbek government was saying that he is alive. But finally, today, they admitted that Islam Karimov is indeed dead. So the 25-year-long era of his reign is over, and it's probably a day that many people in Uzbekistan were looking forward to, given the track record of his government and what a repressive country he has created. But I think from the way it's looking right now, I don't think we will actually get change that so many Uzbeks had hoped for.
Yeah, so who do people think will succeed Karimov? Is there a second in command who's naturally poised to take over?
I think the reason why it took them so long to actually come out and say that he's dead is precisely because they were trying to figure out the succession plan. And it does look like it's now in place. The Prime Minister Mirzoyev is now in charge of the funeral, and that means he's in charge of the country in general. So it was him or another high-level minister, and it's the Prime Minister who clearly won what must have been a real battle for succession, but a very closed battle for succession.
There are many Uzbeks who've known only Karimov as their president. What kind of reaction would you imagine from the Uzbek people upon hearing that Karimov, this leader of many decades, has died?
There aren't many countries quite like Uzbekistan in the world, and it's a country that has been ruled by fear, that has known nothing but complete clampdown on all sorts of dissent, that has seen extraordinary repression and torture in prisons. And of course, in that environment where all political thought, all thought in general, is dominated by the cult of fear, I think it's very hard to measure the true reaction. I think there will be people who have known nothing else, who will be probably genuinely upset. I think there will be people who will be worried about what will come next. And I think there will be a lot of people who will be very indifferent and who will say that nothing will change. And they'll probably be right, because it's very hard to imagine anything changing in Uzbekistan.
Is there a significant opposition there that will challenge any succession plans?
No, there is no opposition in Uzbekistan at all. The opposition has been entirely crushed. He is way up there with some of the most brutal dictators in the world. And I think a lot of people will be quite upset to see him die without seeing the punishment that many feel that he deserved. It's very, very hard to think of a positive legacy of Islam Karimov's years.
So what do you think is going to be the long-term effect of Karimov's brutality psychically on the people of Uzbekistan?
Well, I think it's a country that's generally deeply traumatized by what it has gone through. It's a country that lives in complete denial. You know, I haven't lived in Stalinist times, but there's something very Stalinist about the way that country works. And I've never been to any other place where you literally get off the plane and kind of the fear is tangible. You know, you can almost sense it. People look over their shoulders and they talk in whispers, and there is a resemblance of normal life. But as long as you don't touch, you know, a whole bunch of subjects, all of that in a package makes a very, very gloomy picture. And it's very likely that this will just carry on.
I know he'll be buried in his hometown of Samarkand. When is that going to happen?
It will happen tomorrow on September the 3rd. That's the official announcement. And again, I mean, completely absurd, because we saw the preparations for the funeral. That's what they were preparing for. Citizens were asked to get out into the streets and clean the streets of Samarkand. It's definitely an end of the era.
Natalia Antalava, reporter in Tbilisi, Georgia. Thank you very much, Natalia.
Thank you.
The U.S. Justice Department just announced plans to get out of the private prison business. A bold move, right? Well, our data team has done some digging and found that compared to Great Britain and Australia, for example, the U.S. actually has a much lower proportion of prisoners in privately run jails. Charts, graphs, and more data viz, check it all out at PRI.org. Okay, let's go a bit deeper on prison statistics and look at the place of the world's highest per capita incarceration rates. It's not China or Iran or Russia. It is the state of Louisiana. The numbers are really grim for African-American men. 1 in 7 in Louisiana is behind bars, on parole, or on probation. 1 in 7. Think about that, because lots of people going into prison means a lot of people getting out, too, at some point. And barriers to housing and employment make it hard for ex-convicts to set up stable lives. There's a group in New Orleans, though, with a plan to keep people out of prison once and for all. And it's based on firsthand experience. Here's reporter Nina Feldman.
Calvin Duncan knows a lot about prison. He spent 28 years there.
I was born in New Orleans, but I was raised in Louisiana State Penitentiary. I went to prison in 1982 for murder that I had nothing to do with.
Calvin was exonerated and came home in 2011. Since then, he's spent a lot of time working with people like him who've been wrongfully convicted. But he says some of the biggest problems with the prison system apply to everyone, whether you're innocent or not.
When I came home from prison, I was homeless. I had nowhere to go. I lived with my lawyers. Then the intern that worked on my case allowed me to live in her cottage for a year.
A local nonprofit ultimately gave Calvin a rundown house and helped him fix it up. He lives there now, and every year he offers his spare room to a different exoneree, rent-free. But Calvin knew housing wasn't the only obstacle he'd face coming home. Not many employers want to hire someone with a felony conviction, even if he didn't commit the crime.
Well, I read your application. This is the response. I read your application, and we're going to give you a call. And then they think about, do my employees want to work around a person that's been in prison for 30 years?
So instead of depending on employers to give him a chance, Calvin joined with Kelly Oriens, a New Orleans public defender, to start a group called Rising Foundations. They're renovating an old mansion that will host a transitional housing program for people coming home from prison, where they can get on their feet without worrying about rent or bills. And they've launched a small business incubator for formerly incarcerated entrepreneurs.
And we need to go to see about what it is we need to do with the LLC thing.
Yes. So we actually, so first we had the credit checks, everyone running a credit check, and whoever has not put together their checking account, putting together the checking account.
Some of the entrepreneurs are just starting out, while others are pretty far along on their business plans. Derek Parikh is getting ready to open his own custom eyeglass shop, and he just got in a shipment of new lenses. He's taking stock.
With different frames, say you get a 65-millimeter lens. This would be a 75, so instead of...
Derek trained to be an optician in the Louisiana State Penitentiary, better known as Angola. But even with a skilled trade, Derek realized getting a job after prison wasn't going to be easy, especially in Louisiana, which has more job restrictions for people with felony convictions than any other state.
I can go out applying for jobs all day. Nobody called me. And as soon as I go outside, the first three guys who sell drugs, you see, hey, you can work for me. So it's more convenient for guys to fall into selling drugs than getting a job.
That threat is real. In Louisiana, over half the people released from prison end up back there within 5 years. Derek hopes to avoid that by owning his own business. Plus, this way, he won't get stuck in a lower-level job.
I couldn't move up. I can always be an optician for a company, but I would never be able to be the optometrist. I'm not allowed to do it because I have drug convictions.
Derek figured if he couldn't become an optometrist, he'd just hire one.
That's what a lab would be. A wall would be here the next time.
But starting a company from scratch isn't a sure bet either. Derek's been out of prison for almost 3 years. During that time, he worked at Pearle Vision and saved some money. With that, plus a little help from family, he was able to cover his startup costs. But on top of money, you need steady business. So Derek's been exploring contracts with public institutions like local schools and the VA. The one he's most confident about is the contract to supply glasses at Angola.
And being that that's where I started at and first got knowledge of the eyeglass thing, I would want to give back something to the guys that's in there, not just saying the system or anything, but the guys that's in there.
Derek and others in the incubator may also be more likely to hire people who get out. That's something Calvin Duncan is counting on.
I could start a landscaping business and employ people coming home. I could start a sheetrocking business and employ them coming home. And we don't have to ask him where he has been in life.
Calvin knows there's a long way to go before there's a thriving economy of formerly incarcerated business owners employing people coming out of prison. But he says if Louisiana can lead the world in incarceration, it can lead the world in reentry too. For The World, I'm Nina Feldman, New Orleans.
Fall sports are starting up again. Soccer, football, ice hockey soon enough. And that means brain injuries are a topic of concern for athletes and parents. Author Joanne Gerstner addresses these issues in her new book. It's called Back in the Game, Why Concussion Doesn't Have to End Your Athletic Career. I wanted her to start by answering the basics. What exactly is a concussion?
Simply put, a concussion is an injury to the brain. And I know that sounds extremely simplistic, especially if you're from the neurology community, but any type of blow to the body, so if you get tackled in football or if you trip and fall while you're playing basketball, can lead to the brain being jarred, which can then lead to a concussion. Now, obviously, not all blows, trips, falls, things like that can, you know, produce concussion, but ones that deliver enough force to your brain that breaks that threshold to do produce an injury to the brain, that's where it comes from. So it's really more along the lines of an individual injury that we all could get concussed. If you have a brain, you get a concussion. So the line where we all sustain the injury is different. And that's what makes it such a difficult injury to get a handle on.
And you don't necessarily need to have impact on the head, correct?
Correct. If you have a whiplash injury or if your torso, you know, gets twisted and delivers force through your neck to your head, absolutely.
So we focus on American football when talking about concussions. It's been in the media a lot in the last few years, but remind us how widespread this problem is across many different sports across the world.
Exactly. Skiing, football, or as we like to call it in the United States, soccer, any sport which has enough force to cause, you know, the jolting of the body, such as equestrian. It's amazing. When I watched the Olympics, I watched it through a different prism this time because I looked at every sport from the pole vaulters to the hurdler that tripped over the hurdle and fell awkwardly. I thought, wow, look at all the concussions that could potentially be happening across the board, not just in the sports that you think where it really is happening.
Yeah, so we're a pretty litigious society. How do other countries respond to the science of concussion and the related damage?
Well, it's been fascinating watching this. I was lucky enough to attend a conference in Zurich in 2012 about concussion, and it basically brought together all the major sports bodies around the country. And I really got to see the evolution across the world of concussion thought and sports. So Europe was kind of in the middle. We're like, yeah, there's some concussions, but maybe it's not as bad as the Americans think. South America, I met one doctor who said none of my soccer players get concussions, which we know is not true. And Asia was kind of downplaying it. So it kind of seemed to be perceived, now again, that was 2012, as a North American thing. And now I've really seen a change in Europe that all the leagues are taking concussions seriously. The equestrian groups are mandating the wearing of helmets at all levels. So we are seeing some evolutions, maybe not as quickly as we'd like to across the globe, but we're getting there.
So I'm curious, when you watched the Olympics, were you kind of dialed into how coaches and teams were deciding whether to keep players in the game, so to speak?
Absolutely, yes.
What did you see?
I saw some interesting responses. There was one hurdler, I forget what country right now, but literally she fell hard. I mean, went down hard. Was laying on the track. It was one of the early heats, and a coach went over, and you could clearly see that she was in some sort of distress, and I'm not going to say she was concussed because obviously I'm not her doctor, but basically, you know, just like shake it off, let's keep going, and she was running in a heat later in the day. So I'm hoping she received proper assessment for a concussion, and then on the other hand, I know the divers, basketball players and the real contact sports, I know they had trainers on hand, doctors on hand, and they were really taking it seriously. So again, I saw some real hopeful signs of some evolution in the way we treat things, but I also saw kind of the old school of, hey, shake it off, let's keep going. It's not that big of a deal.
Isn't there a uniform standard that's been issued by some sports body about what constitutes immediate removal from play?
Yes, yes. The standard we are going by in the United States, and it's being adopted pretty much across the board in major sports organizations, is if you are suspected of having a concussion, you come out and you stay out until you're properly evaluated and it can be determined that you're not concussed. So that usually means that if they think you're hurt, you're going to stay out of the practice or out of the game. So it's kind of the cliche they use is when in doubt, sit it out. Mm. And it's probably a best approach to take, especially with children, because why put them back in? It's not worth the risk.
Joanne, have you ever been concussed yourself?
Not to my knowledge, but I did play softball, and I remember one time where I was run over at the plate as a catcher, and I did have my bell rung, and I felt fuzzy. Obviously, no one pulled me out. No one thought I had concussion. I got better. Everything's fine. So undiagnosed concussion? Probably, but officially, thankfully, no.
Joanne Gerstner, the co-author of the new book about concussion, Back in the Game. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. There's a new 2-pound coin issued to commemorate it, also a series of postage stamps that make up a comic strip about the event. That's just two ways. The 350th anniversary of the Great Fire of London is being marked in the UK. London went up in flames on this day in 1666. The fire torched most of the city, including St. Paul's Cathedral. It was the British capital's version of Chicago's fire in 1871. Our own Leo Hornack is in London. And Leo, you're at a place that gives you a perspective on the city that really helps to understand that fire. Where are you right now?
I'm sitting at the top of what you could best describe as a 17th century skyscraper. It's the monument to the Great Fire, and just on my left I can see St. Paul's Cathedral, built because the old cathedral was burnt in the fire.
Yeah, so this is where it started. Explain what happened on this day in 1666.
Well, a street away from where I am, a baker was just going to bed one evening. He denies exactly how this happened, but effectively he forgot to turn the oven off, and the fire started, and it began to spread, and incredibly quickly, because you have to remember, this was still the medieval city. It was tightly packed, wooden buildings filled with lots of goods and services, many of them highly flammable. And in just 4 days, in fact, a quarter of the city was razed to the ground. They think 100,000 people lost their homes.
With Chicago and the O'Leary family's cow, people have got to blame these fires on someone or something. Is it certain this fire started at a bakery?
Well, I mean, as much as anything can be certain when you're talking about a 17th century fire in an oven. But, I mean, all the evidence points to that. There were a few conspiracy theories at the time. What's really incredible is the actual details of how the fire took place. I mean, this is just one of the accounts. Oh, miserable and calamitous spectacle, the noise and cracking and thunder of the impetuous flames, the shrieking of the women and children, the fall of towers, houses and churches, like a hideous storm. It's one of the first disasters that are recorded. Individual diarists like Samuel Pepys, London's great diarist, wrote day-by-day accounts of what was happening. I mean, we know that when the fire began to approach his house, he got so worried that he buried his expensive Parmesan cheese in the back garden.
So this Great Fire of London in 1666, how's it playing out in the collective consciousness of Londoners?
Oh, I think in a big way. If you grow up in this city, and it's one of the things you learn about that you knew was one of the big markers in your city. And in London, it became the beginning of a great era of prosperity and empire and world power eventually.
There was Leo Hornack speaking with me from the Monument to the Great Fire of London, a blaze that destroyed much of the city 350 years ago today. Leo, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Marco.
Earlier this week, we told you about the death of Mexican superstar Juan Gabriel. He died of a heart attack, age 66, last Sunday while on tour in the U.S. Tomorrow, his memorial service will happen in his hometown, Ciudad Juarez, in northern Mexico. He's something of a legend, adored by the public, and one of Latin America's most successful recording artists. From Ciudad Juarez, Monica Ortiz Uribe with the Fronteras Desk at KJZZ tells us about the singer's humble beginnings at the border.
Juan Gabriel is most famous for his love songs, including this one. It's a love song he wrote to Ciudad Juarez, the Mexican border city where he grew up. It's the biggest door into the most beautiful country, he croons, describing Juarez as precious, loyal, and sincere. Claiming Juan Gabriel as a native son is a huge point of pride for a city whose image is often tainted by drugs and violence. Outside Gabriel's palatial mansion, not far from the historic downtown, it's a non-stop party, complete with mariachis. The ornate fencing around his home is covered in multicolored wreaths, balloons, and handwritten notes that say thank you and I love you. Sure, there's a few tears, but the overwhelming emotion is joy.
En mi casa le gusta mi mamá.
Gloria Garcia is a publicist with bright lipstick who says that in her house, everybody listens to Juan Gabriel. Her mom, her kids, and grandkids. Juan Gabriel filled our hearts in a way that no artist can ever replace, she says. To understand why, you've got to turn to his roots. Juan Gabriel's life played out like a telenovela.
Mi nombre es José Antonio Elguea.
José Antonio Elguea used to play in a Spanish band called Los Churumbeles. His family owned a couple of restaurants in downtown Juarez where a young Juan Gabriel would sing in exchange for meals. Gabriel spent most of his childhood in an orphanage. As he got older, he performed anywhere he could, bars, buses, restaurants.
Oiga, maestro, fíjese que yo tengo una canción.
One day, Elguea says Gabriel came to ask his opinion on a song he'd just written. Then he began to play the song.
Y era precisamente esa de no tengo dinero ni nada que dar.
No tengo dinero ni nada que dar. Lo único que tengo es amor para amar.
This song led to Gabriel's first recording contract in 1971. It's called No Tengo Dinero, or I Don't Have Any Money. It's about choosing love over money, a common theme in his music.
He was just so humble from the heart.
Justino Aguila is a freelance journalist who writes about Latin music.
And because he really is a true rags-to-riches story, I think people resonated to that. You could be a mechanic, or you could be a wealthy Latino millionaire or billionaire. And Juan Gabriel got to you either way.
Poco a poco, lentamente, enseñaste a vivir.
In a studio apartment, a trio of young Juarez musicians rehearse one of Gabriel's duets. 22-year-old Sergio Duran studied for 15 years in a boys' boarding school started by Juan Gabriel. The school closed a year ago when funding dried up. Duran was an orphan himself when he started there. Now, he earns a living making music. Without that opportunity, I don't know where I'd be, Duran says. Juan Gabriel is my idol. For The World, I'm Monica Ortiz Uribe in Ciudad Juarez.
Our friend Beto Arco shared his love for the music of Juan Gabriel. You can listen to that conversation and watch videos of the singer throughout the years. We've got all of that at PRI.org. And we leave you today with this classic song of heartache by Juan Gabriel, Querida. The World's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman, wishing you a great Labor Day weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.